And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, where we are one day away from the 2019 NBA Finals, and I cannot think of a single better person to preview it with than the great Jeff Van Gundy, calling in live from beautiful Toronto, Ontario, Canada. How you doing, sir?
Doing well. How are you?
Good. I'm excited for a new matchup. Doesn't it feel good to have a little fresh blood?
Yeah, it's interesting, too, like having the Raptors in it. I think if you're an NBA fan, you understand what a great fan base they have and how fun it was to always compete up here. But maybe if you're a fan, you don't understand, you know, just what a great city Toronto is, or how well their fan base supports, you know, the Toronto Raptors. So it should be fun.
They're nuts in the best way possible. It's absolutely, they're insane up there. It's good. The atmosphere is going to be incredible, because they look, I mean, this is the franchise of the purple dinosaur jerseys and Vince Carter bailing and T-Mac, not bailing, but sort of ending his era there early, and Bosch bailing, and Andrea Bargnani is the number one pick. It's been a rough run is all I'm saying. And they, and like, there is a core group of fans there who stuck with them for a long time. And this is going to be fun. I'm excited. I'm more excited.
I was flying up to Toronto last night and, from Houston, where I live, and Tracy McGrady, obviously still lives in Houston, and he works on The Jump with Rachel, and just by happenstance, he's sitting right next to me, and we traded Raptor-Knicks stories the whole way up, and it's awesome to see someone you coach, but also early on in his career that you competed against. And, you know, he said something about Toronto, like it's his favorite city, and I find that amazing for a kid from a small town in the Orlando area to be drafted to the Raptors and fall in love with the city instead of just being homesick. I think it says a lot about McGrady, but also a lot about Toronto.
Give me one good Knicks Raptors story that was reminisced about on this flight.
Well. The main one was just how great Carter was and McGrady were from day one. I think Vince Carter, because right now, and there's always recency bias, you know, we declare guys the greatest who ever played, or, you know, you only remember them for how they are now. You see Vince Carter as a guy who came in, or who's in the NBA right now as a role player, right? I think people, if you didn't have to guard him, forget how dominant he was day one in the NBA. Like, back then when he came in, we didn't double basically anybody, and he absolutely tortured us from day one. He made us. We played them in his rookie year in the playoffs. We went from not doubling him and him just pummeling us, both in the low post, jumping over us, offensive rebounds, the whole bit, and a very underrated passer, to where we doubled him on every possession, every place on the court. He was that good. And I think, again, if you're a younger person, you remember Vince Carter in one way. If you're old as a fossil like me, you remember Vince Carter as an absolutely dominant NBA player who had to be doubled.
Well, and people remember the leaping ability and jumping over Friedrich Weiss and all that, but like, the first step is almost what I remember more than the leaping ability. The combination of the first step and what he could do with the ball in one hand, and how those two things together, you just had no idea what was coming. And the first step was so long and so quick that if he just gets you to twitch one way with a little ball fake, like, you're done. It's over. He's at the rim.
And he was so powerful, like people, like the strength, the combination of all you're saying, first step, strength, power, jumping, and skill. Like, I think people, you know, the dunkers that we remember, we never then think, well, they were also really skilled. Vince Carter was a hell of a passer. You know, he could make the pass against the double team coming off a high pick and roll to the weak side corner, you know, 25 years ago, right? Or 20 years ago, whatever it was. And like you double him in the post, he could make the right plays. I mean, this guy, what a talent he was. And so McGrady at that time was thought of as a defender because we had Allen Houston and his length was incredible. So they were playing through Carter. McGrady was starting, but it was more so as a he was like a defensive rebounder, and then he goes on to becoming, you know, the leading scorer in the NBA, and then, you know, to one of the great passing pick and roll players to have ever played. So that's why, to me, like that team, they just weren't able to keep together. But if they would have, think about it, McGrady and Carter in their prime over a decade. I mean,
well, they've talked about it before, the regrets they have. And like, I know Vince has done stuff with the jump, including in a couple of previous finals. I think Tracy obviously has done, is on the jump all the time. The Raptors, I hope that they get, I mean, maybe Vince is already going to be there. Vince needs to be at one of these games in Toronto. Like, they need to bring Bosch back. They need, like, all the Toronto, all the, whatever Toronto sort of heavyweight figures exist, if they want to be there, I think it would be cool if Vince, my guess is Vince will be there anyway. I literally have no idea. He might be there already for all I know. I just think it would be awesome if, I think those wounds have healed too. Like, they're going to retire Vince Carter's number at some point. They have to. They're going to probably retire Bosch's number. They should, I think. I think it would be cool if all those guys were there. Maybe it's too much. I don't know. Maybe it's too distracting, but I think it would be awesome if they just turned this into a whole thing. And by the way, speaking of history, and like you said,
can I say one more thing, Zach? It's one of the worst trades in NBA history that's never talked about.
Which one, Vince?
I think it was draft night, right? They traded. It was Antoine Jameson for Carter.
Oh, the initial trade. The initial trade. Yeah, I thought you meant Vince to the Nets when Vince kind of pouted his way out of Toronto.
No. I mean, those are forced. I'm saying draft night. You know, Golden State, right? Think about it. They gave up. You know,
it was straight up. It was straight up.
Turned into a great player. You know,
it was just, it was straight up Vince for Antoine Jameson, who, you know, nice player. I believe he cracked 20,000 points. I don't want to hear about Antoine Jameson in the Hall of Fame. There's like a Hall of Fame sniff test, and you have talked about.
No. We can get on that, and it just, like, it's not just Antoine Jameson.
No, it's lots of things.
How the Hall of Fame has been reduced to the Hall of Very Good instead of the all-time greats, and that's why I just don't understand why we don't have an NBA Hall of Fame. Like, there's a Pro Football Hall of Fame, and there's a College Football Hall of Fame, and we should have that separation as well.
Amen. People, after a long and grueling regular season and 4 months of the NBA playoffs, that may be an exaggeration. The finals are tipping off this week, and DraftKings, the leader in daily fantasy sports, is having its biggest online basketball contest ever. That seems pretty big. If you've been thinking about trying DraftKings, now is the time. I've never tried it before, but I've always been curious. This is your time. With Single Game Showdown, that's the name of this contest, there are $2.5 million in total prizes up for grabs with a grand prize of $1 million and do your best Dr. Evil voice. Here's how it works. All you have to do is draft 6 players from Thursday's game 1, 1 captain and 5 other guys. You get points for rebounds, assists, points, and more. And your captain earns 1.5 times his points, so pick that person carefully. It's that simple. 6 players from 1 game, just stay under the salary cap. See how your team stacks up against the competition. Go to DraftKings.com or download the app now, and then use the promo code LOWE, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast, and enter the all-new Single Game Showdown contest this Thursday, the day of Game 1, to compete for the $1 million top prize. That's promo code LOWE, L-O-W-E, to compete for the $1 million top prize only at DraftKings. The game inside the game. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. Let's talk about this finals, because I think Vince is actually a good segue into this finals for other reasons. Well, first of all, I do want to congratulate you on, I think, the line on television that made me laugh the hardest out of nowhere in this whole playoffs was sometime during the Western Conference Finals, when the Curry family wearing their, you know, reversible jerseys. By the way, the Curry family, It's just ridiculous. Is there anything bad about the Curry family? I want to devote an entire year to unearthing like one unsavory detail about the Curry family. They're amazing. They're sitting in the stands watching Seth versus Steph. And Breen, I think it was Breen, kind of teed you guys up for, you know, this must be hard for, on some level, hard for them to watch their sons compete against each other. You know, Jeff, I mean, think about it. You and Stan. We went head to head in the playoffs, Heat Knicks. I mean, that must have been really hard for your parents. And then there was this like beat of silence. And then you come in with, you know, see, I don't think that should be true because Stan was on the evil Heat teams and like we were the good guys. They should have just been rooting for me and against Stan. I almost spit out my coffee watching that. That was a wonderful line. And you meant it. I think you meant it. I don't think you're being completely tongue in cheek.
No, they just definitely been rooting for us. I mean, you know, the Heat start fights and like they're just not, you know, I always get on Stan. As the Knicks, we competed with honor and they just were some dirty dudes on Miami. So yeah, but you know what, going back to the Curry family, as you're saying, I think what gets overlooked in all of it, again, because of Steph's greatness, and, you know, what a great story that he's competing against his brother and his brother, you know, all the different stops he's made along the way. And you can forget how good Del Curry was.
Like, oh, my God.
Like, he played here in Toronto as well and in Charlotte and in Milwaukee. I mean, he, you know, he had this unbelievable – and, like, when you talk about size and quickness of release, like he didn't shoot it off the dribble like, you know, his son. But as far as catch and shoot with that size, that quickness of release and that pure stroke, I mean, he was today's like, you know, Klay Thompson, as far as you couldn't come off of him like at all, like not even a little bit to give any support or help. And I think that's, in the whole Curry family dynamics that we go through today, that to me is the most undertold story that no one has gone into, just what a great career he is. And also, I have a good friend who coached in Charlotte for a number of years, and Steve Clifford. And the thing that always impressed me is how he raved about Del Curry as a person, how he wanted the best for everybody in that organization. And he's a very good broadcaster. But more importantly, he's just so supportive of others who are trying to, you know, win and achieve their dreams. And I think, you know, as we rave about Steph and, you know, Seth and the mom, I think sometimes Dell gets sort of overlooked. His greatness gets overlooked.
I feel like that's the destiny of a good dad, is you just become – he's not grumpy or grouchy or a buffoon like a TV dad or something. I feel like the destiny of a good dad is you just sort of seed the stage and become like a dad jokes guy and let everyone else shine. And like, you just have to be okay with it. But you're right though. There are like good shooters and great shooters. And then there are like the holy shit, I can't even watch. I'm too scared if you're cheering against that guy's team shooters. And I bet as a coach, Del Curry was one of the last ones where like, I can't, like, I'm frightened as he's going up for a shot. I'm frightened at what's about to happen to me.
Well, he did that to me. The ball got kicked to him late in the garden, right in front of our bench. And it's like the old, you just turn away because you already know the result. And, it was so pure. It was like right down the middle. I mean, it wasn't even like, you know, when he got those opportunities, it was like a layup. And, yeah, amazing, amazing shooter.
So here we are. We're in the finals. I don't really remember a situation like this where one of the four best players in the NBA or whatever is injured, and we're sort of at a loss to figure out what kind of series this is going to be in the aggregate. Because if Kevin Durant comes back, it's going to be two different series. It's going to be the one that happened without him and the one that happened with him. And everything changes if he comes back and is 80, 90% of whatever of himself. But I think with or without him, and that's part, I think a fully healthy Warriors team, I think is pretty close to unbeatable in a 7-game series. I don't see any team, I don't see Toronto being able to beat the fully healthy Warriors. Now, if you get If it's 2-2 after four and then Kevin Durant comes back and you got to win a best of three and he's 70%, you got a shot. And the primary reason you got a shot is Kawhi Leonard is just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, he's still relatively young in his career. He's had a few, you know, a couple of his early long playoff runs, particularly his first two, he was more a role player than star. His last three playoff runs are absolutely ridiculous. 2015-16 when they lost to the Thunder, 16-17 when the Zaza thing upends his season, and then this year. His player efficiency rating, now I understand you don't care about player efficiency rating, it has a lot of statistical flaws, 28.6, 31.5, 28.5 this year, and like anything over 28 is all-time territory. Here's another one. In the entire history of the NBA, now obviously pre-three-point era is excluded here, there have been three guys in the history of the league who have played 3,000 playoff minutes and shot 50-40. Kawhi Leonard is the first, and actually there's really only two, because the third one is Buck Williams, who's one of two from three. The only other guy with any volume is Al Horford. I mean, he's shooting like a Splash Brother and scoring like Michael Jordan and defending like Scottie Pippen. And I don't think it's hyperbole to say that if he plays like this and they win and he wins finals MVP, which he would if conditions A and B are met, he's already in the pantheon of greatest postseason players in the history of the NBA, period. He is that good. And what he did to Giannis in the last round, I frankly didn't think he could do. I did not think he could score 30 a game and guard that freight train that's coming at you on every single possession. So you can tell me about the Warriors are just blitzed Portland without Durant. They're 31-1 in their last 32 with Curry and without Durant. And home court doesn't matter to them. They're a great road team and they've been here before and the pressure is not going to get to them, blah, blah, blah. If that dude is on the other team and Kevin Durant is out or limited, Toronto has a real chance to win this series, I think. Do you agree or no? Or to you, are the Warriors still the Warriors, and until you see it, they're going to trounce everybody?
No, I think they have a chance, a good chance, with or without Durant playing. I think that Raptors are really good for many of the reasons that you just spoke about, the greatness of Kawhi Leonard. But I also think it's a very well-constructed team who has a lot of answers for a lot of different problems. The Warriors here's my three things, the main reasons. Home court, health, and rhythm. I think all three of those go to Toronto, right? And I think the rhythm one is being a little bit overlooked in that the Warriors have been off a long time. And it is hard to maintain NBA rhythm when you, no matter what you do, no matter what Steve Kerr scrimmaging, referees, whatever they have done, it is hard to maintain elite-level rhythm and intensity when you've been off as long as they have. So going into Game 1, I think there are significant advantages for Toronto beyond how great Kawhi Leonard is. And I think also, because we are talking about a sweep, we forget against a team in Portland that was missing their third best player in Nurkic, that the Warriors were down, and significantly so, in three of those four games. So I do not see it, whether Durant is back or not, and I don't expect to see him in this series, but whether he's back or not, I think Toronto... I think if you're overlooking their chances, I think you're making a mistake.
Now, the Warriors could come out and win the first game tomorrow, and we all look foolish because this is what the Warriors do. I picked the Warriors to win in seven. That was my pick. I came close to Warriors in six, and then I thought, you know what? What the hell? I like Toronto. I like Kawhi. Kawhi is an absolute killer. Let's have it go the distance. And the Warriors, the ultimate way, if Kevin Durant leaves, to end this run, not that it's ending because the evidence would suggest it's not, what the ultimate capstone to four straight would be a game seven win on the road, which is the hardest win to get in the NBA. And by the way, on another broadcast, you rightfully credited Portland as they were cratering against the Warriors and blowing another lead. You rightfully, and people start talking about, oh, Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum aren't ready for this. And oh my God, you know, what happened to them? Now they're the trash brothers. Enough with that. But you rightfully credit, hey, I don't care if Denver is maybe not as respected as a number two seed or whatever. You win game seven on the road. That's like four wins. That's, did you ever win a decide? You won that Miami game on the road, right? That was a game five. Did you ever win any other series?
We won three times in Miami.
In decisive games?
Yeah. That's why, because it didn't lead to a championship, it can get over, you know, like the accomplishments of a play of players to do that three consecutive years on the road in a decisive game against the same opponent. A terrific accomplishment. And you don't win on the road like Portland. You know, again, everything is so, you know, dissected.
What happened yesterday?
Now.
Yeah, what happened yesterday?
And it's just. But, like, to win a game on the road in Denver, who is an unbelievable home team with a really good team, to do that when your star, like Lillard, didn't play well, that's an incredible accomplishment. And C.J. McCollum, you know, played so, so very well. And, look, if they were able, like, they're up eight, I believe, with four to go in game two. If they're able to hold on and win that game, that could have easily gone seven without Durant. You know, they're not going to lose both games, I don't believe, on the at home if they win game two. And, you know, it can be far different. That's why these series sometimes they're so close and they're decided by one or two or three plays. And what we never talk about is how much good fortune and good luck play into winning in pro sports. And to me, the unfortunate thing for Golden State is, you know, Iguodala is probably back, but I mean, just by happenstance, Durant may not play or may be marginalized in this series, and Cousins, you know, he's been out. So, I mean, there's so much that goes into winning in an NBA series or championship, and that's why I think, you know, Toronto has a lot going for it. I know they're missing Ananobi, but, like, you know, they're healthy, they're in rhythm, and they got home court, and I think they got a great shot.
Well, the first two games, to your point, are going to be really interesting because this is the first time the Warriors have ever started on the road in a final series, and I believe in all the games one and two of the last four finals, they're 7-1. I think they only lost game two of the first series against Cleveland when LeBron spiked the ball on the court. And in a lot of those games, I do think there is a certain aspect to you go through the Eastern Conference. Now, this is a different Eastern Conference, and Toronto just beat two great teams to get here. It's not like Cleveland rolling through this mediocrity to get here. But I think there's a learning curve to guarding the Warriors where they have hit people with some sort of shock value in the first game of the finals. They've hit Cleveland with some, oh my God, this looks and feels completely different than anything we faced on the way here. And they made a lot of hay in those series out of just, we're up 2-0. Like Leandro Barbosa has 20 points and Sean Livingston has 18 and you don't even know what hit you and we're up 2-0 and the series is over. Like you're just not going to beat them 4 out of 5. And so now they have to do the opposite thing and go on the road where maybe that shock value advantage is there, but the home court advantage is not there. And they have been off for a long time, although they're used to that. But I'm going to flip it on its head. I think they're excited to start on the road. I think they like this, like, I think it's going to be invigorating for them. I think they like the idea of a new challenge. And I also think they're used to the long layoffs. Like, I'm very interested to see these first couple games, and particularly tomorrow. Because if Toronto loses tomorrow, as they lost game one in Milwaukee and they were fine. This is the Warriors. It's a different animal. And it's a different style of series for them in terms of where and how it's starting. But I'm kind of confident they're going to come out and play a very good game in game one. Now, to the rhythm point, let me ask you this. If Cousins is available as a coach, where do you put him in the rotation?
Brutally hard decision, because here is a guy, and you want to be about what's best for your players, right? He came to you and off a terrible injury that undercut his whole market value. He signs with you, and he's given you some, you know, good moments, right? Then he gets hurt. Now you still progress through the playoffs, and you come to the finals. Are you really going to not play DeMarcus Cousins and stay with your same rotation? And I think so much of it comes to Cousins and what he sees for himself. You know, can he be happy with 8 to 10 minutes and just being a part of it? Or because he's always been a focal point for every organization and team he's played for, can he not handle, you know, this lesser role? And I don't know anything about Cousins. I, you know, obviously never coached him. But I think so much of Steve Kerr's decision is based on DeMarcus Cousins' outlook and what he's able to handle. Because ultimately, Steve's one job is to put on the floor the team that gives them the best chance to win. And that always involves difficult and challenging decisions. I don't think you could have a more challenging decision than, do we play and how much do we play DeMarcus Cousins if he's available to play?
See, I think the injury has almost made the decision easier for Steve, because to me, now again, I'm like you, I'm not with the team, I'm not around the team behind closed doors, or I don't see how fit DeMarcus is or whatever. But to me, the rhythm that Curry and Clay and Draymond are in, playing this style, pre-Durant style that they've played for so long, I am not plopping a recovering DeMarcus Cousins who plays a slower style and needs the ball a lot. I'm not plopping him into that flow. I'm just not doing it. I'm not, unless we go down 2-0 and it's a disaster and we just got to start trying a lot of stuff, I'm not risking the disruption of that flow to get DeMarcus Cousins post touches, particularly when also starting him would mean, he's got to defend the pick and roll against Lowry and Leonard. And I'm saying, hey, look, DeMarcus, we had plans for this year. You were starting. We played pretty well. Then we hit some roadblocks defensively. Then you got injured. This is the finals, man. Like, here's what we want you to do. You come off the bench and you play those minutes that Steph is out and Draymond is out. Like, they're playing this funky lineup with Clay as the only of the three stars that are on the floor. Now, again, all this changes when KD comes back, if he comes back. I want you in those minutes, and you are just going to mash people. Just mash their second unit. Mash Ibaka. Carry us a little bit when we need a little punch, and like, they're doing a good job on Clay. They're chasing Clay around screens and we can't get anything else loose. Mash people. And if you play well in those minutes and you look good, yeah, there's going to be opportunities to play a crunch time here or there, or to extend into, you know, when the starters start coming back on the floor late in the second quarter or whatever. Like that's if he's available to play, that's my approach. And by the way, I'm also, I know Steve likes to play everybody and all that, and he likes Looney coming off the bench. I think it's time to start Kevon Looney. I don't know why that hasn't happened yet. I have inklings as to why, but he's been awesome. Kevon Looney is good.
Well, he's played very well there. You can't deny that. And I don't think there's any probably thought to starting Cousins right away. At least I don't think so. But again, that so much of that goes to how Cousins sees himself and how he sees the situation. You know, I've never bought into that whole notion, you can't lose your starting position because of injury. Well, why not? Why does that make any sense? You can lose minutes for any number of reasons, and many aren't your fault. They're just how a season sort of transforms itself. So I hope for Cousins' sake that he is able to play, that he's accepting of whatever role Steve Kerr thinks that he should play or could play. And also I hope that he doesn't lose sight of the fact that even though he has had two brutal injuries in the past two seasons, that's taken away so many opportunities in the playoffs, that you don't get chances in the finals like this very often. So whatever role it is, enjoy it, because it does these things. You know, the Warriors now are a dynasty, but before that, they've gone forever without having played in the finals, and it doesn't last forever. And so enjoy the opportunities that you have. And if he can get himself in the right framework and he's in good enough shape and he's got good enough rhythm, he can certainly help them in limited minutes.
You know, I was thinking about what you just said. Somebody tweeted some video of Ibaka, Serge Ibaka, walking into a restaurant in Toronto, I believe the night that they won Game 6. And the whole restaurant just, like, erupts, and he's a hero. And, like, Serge Ibaka's a bench player now. He's been up and down in the playoffs. Like, he hasn't been outstanding. I think he's been solid. He's done his job. He had one great three-point shooting game in Game 7 against Philly when they absolutely desperately needed it. And other than that, has been ice cold from three. But he's done his job. It's not like not a star anymore, not a starter anymore. If you are part of a championship contending, if you're part of a finals team and you're part of a champion eventually, if you're part of it, even if you play 8-10 minutes, whatever, like a much lesser role than Ibaka, like you're a hero forever. You get to be part of it too. You're swept up in it too. You're part of the legend. Even if you're DeMarcus Cousins, you know, the guy who had to find a spot on the two-time defending champion super team because no one else wanted to pay you what you thought you were worth because you tore your Achilles, like, you're still a part of it. And I think, like, just for some reason, seeing Ibaka walk into that restaurant, because you see all the time, you hear about players who sort of, like, I think of Aaron Gordon a lot like this. Now we're totally off on a tangent, but, like, Aaron Gordon has been very vocal about he wants to be Paul George. He wants to play like LeBron. He wants to run a lot of pick and roll and score 25 a game. And I keep thinking to myself, man, Aaron Gordon, you don't have to call a single play for him, and he could score 16, 10 rebounds, 5 assists, elite defense across all 5 positions. And you do that on a winning team, you're an all-star. Like, everything you want from scoring 25 points a game and being LeBron comes to you by doing that. And it's hard to get some players to get into that mindset. For some reason, the Ibaka video, I totally agree with you. If you're a Cousin, you just got to be like, you know what? If I'm even a small part of this, I go down in history forever.
Well, and also, all those role players, their contributions get over-dramatized. A lot of these guys could be replaced by other players, and the results wouldn't change. That's why, but in it, I mean, what a great opportunity. I mean, doesn't mean, like, I always think about, you know, you mentioned Aaron Gordon, right? Like, think about Draymond Green. Had a very, very below average regular season, right? And is anybody talking about that now?
No.
All they're talking about is versatility, intensity, defense, passing, you know, all these things. So you don't even have to be really good for really long in those roles. Like you said about Ibaka, Game 7. You have one game like that in this run. You don't need to be consistent. The guy that needs to be consistent is Lowry, is Kawhi Leonard, right? I mean, those guys have to carry your team with a consistency. But the role players, they can play well on this night and not so well on this night and have their legend cemented by winning and by the truly great players carrying a team. And you see it with Curry and, you know, like, I always laugh at the slogan strength in numbers because it's really, truly strength in stars, and the numbers come along with the stars.
People, it's that time of year again, the playoffs, basketball's home stretch. This is where all the hard work pays off when we see who's tough enough to be crowned the champion of the NBA. It's where players are more driven than ever to go further, faster, and longer. And that's what drives Goodyear to make tires that do the very same thing. Goodyear knows that performance is everything, whether it's on the road or on the basketball court. So when it comes to choosing tires, let Goodyear.com help you choose what's best. Goodyear, more driven. Okay, let's get into it. Speaking of Kawhi and his consistency, which has just been, I mean, the guy is just a machine. And I know people will take that as a pun on his personality, but he just doesn't have a bad game. It's crazy. So if Durant is playing, that's who Kawhi is guarding. And that was the case in the regular season. That's been the case in the past. Durant is not playing. And so Nick Nurse has this big sandbox now to play with. You know, who does, you have this ultimate destroyer. And obviously against the Warriors, you're going to have to switch a lot. That's just the nature of the beast. So maybe this question is irrelevant. But as a coach, game one, first possession, what are you doing on defense with Kawhi Leonard?
Well, I think his matchup would be Draymond Green. That would be my thought. But I think it's so much, it depends on how much do you want him to run around chasing Thompson and Curry if he was to match up with them, and how much switching are you going to do off ball. The idea that switching is the best way to play the Warriors, I would dispute in many ways. You saw Houston guard him. I think Houston is so different defensively as far as from a lineup standpoint that their switching had an impact. I think you saw Portland off ball not switch as much, which I think, you know, was fine too. I think because of the way they move, you have to first establish, if you're Nick Nurse, how much are we going to play like we've always played defense? How much are we going to change? And how much are we going to switch off ball? Because the switching of the off ball stuff leads to so many layups because of the pressure that Curry's and Thompson's shooting put on you, and as good a trigger and decision maker that Green is, that you give up these layups, and Curry still gets 36. And so I think you really have to decide that first, because that then tells you, you know, who you want to put Kawhi Leonard on. If you want to switch a lot, then it really doesn't matter who his matchup is. If you don't want to switch a lot, then you have to decide how much you want Kawhi Leonard running around with Thompson or Curry, particularly early in the game. So I think, to me, those are the decisions that, you know, a coaching staff gets paid to make, and there are no easy decisions in that regard. This idea that switching is always better, I think has been proven time and again to not be true. I think switching is easier, but that doesn't mean it's better.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the greatness of the Warriors is that they have an answer for everything, right? I mean, you sag off their guys who can't shoot, and they got a lot of guys who can't shoot, and boom, those guys become screeners and handoff guys, and you're done, because Curry and Thompson are turning the corner clear.
I think you have to make the decision, like, again, just not to interrupt or cut you off.
No, go.
Do you pressure the ball, or do you sag and try to clog the lane? And I think every decision that you make impacts another part of your defense. The plans have to all fit together. So you can stand on the top side of Curry and Thompson and prevent them from running their route off a pin down if you're sagging the ball, right? If you're protecting in the lane.
Right.
Because then you have a person to protect against the back cut. But it all has to fit together. My thing would be, like, I would pressure everybody on the floor above the free throw line. Like, I'm not going to sag off anybody. I'm going to pressure the ball. But the one place I haven't seen people adjust like I think they should is when they drop the ball into the low post to Draymond Green. With his back to the basket, I am backing off a good step or two so I can clog the lane against any back cut, because I think the split action is where they create a lot of their layups, and I would try to back off and clog the lane when Green has his back to the basket in a mid-post type of situation. I see a lot of teams sag off him at the high post. I would do just the opposite. I would pressure the ball above the free throw line, but when he caught it with his back to the basket, that's where I'd back off. And if he wanted to take turnaround jumpers from the mid-post area, he's certainly capable of making them, and I would entertain that all series long.
Well, this is why they sort of paralyze you into this confusion of like, okay, so I'm helping off the non-shooters, but then, okay, but now that non-shooter has the ball, so am I supposed to press them, or am I not supposed to press them? What's the rule that we have here? And then
that would be mine. Yeah, that would be mine. Absolutely.
But then you're thinking, and if you're thinking, you're dead. If you're thinking too much, you're dead. Because, and then you see this in some series, like Portland did this a bunch of times where Draymond had the ball in the post and Looney was above him at the 3-point line, and Looney's guy was playing way off Looney, almost like doubling Draymond, but not really. And then Looney just screens for Curry and you're done. It's very easy from the outside to say, why are you putting two guys near Draymond Green in the post? Just let him take his goofy floaters in the post. But you're such in a haze of like, all right, well, I'm guarding Looney. He can't shoot. That means I have to help. And to your point about the switching, they're so well versed now in teams switching against him that like that split action, which for people who don't know is when the two of their players kind of come together and then burst apart. And when Steph and Clay are the two guys, it's just good luck. But you know, they slip screens. They set different screens at different angles. They don't even set the screen like they stop 5 feet in advance and cut to the rim. And like they catch you in between switches, or they cut before you've even executed your switch. They're so good at that that again, they have an answer for everything. But I will say this, and I agree with you. I would put Kawhi on Draymond. I don't know that they're going to do that. I think that's probably one of their top two choices is my guess. But I would put him on Draymond for the simple reason that the one thing that I've really, truly come to believe about the Warriors is that you have to be able to switch the Curry Green pick and roll to beat them. You have to. Now, you can't do it every time, because if you show them something every time, it becomes easy for them to pick it apart. But I just think back to that Houston game 6, and you were there when they ran that Curry Green empty side pick and roll 12 times in a row, and Houston defended it the same way every time. They had PJ Tucker blitz it, Draymond rolls, gets the ball, and then it's layup, lob to Looney, floater, dribble handoff to Curry when they fool him, blah, blah, blah. Like, I just think fundamentally you need to, like, this goes back to the Oklahoma City series when the Thunder almost won. They almost won that series because Durant guarded Draymond and switched on to Curry, and it freaked the Warriors out. And I think you can't beat them. Even without Durant, and Durant is replaced by a non-shooter, which means that as Green is making those plays, he has less shooting around him. He's just too good, and their players are too smart that if you give him an endless 4-on-3, he's going to beat you. They're going to beat you. So that's why I like Kawhi on Draymond, because I just like the idea of him switching a lot of on-ball stuff. But like you said, if you're going to switch everything off the ball, it doesn't even matter.
Right. I mean, and I think, again, the idea, you've prepared all season long, whatever your habits are, you have to ask yourself, if we haven't switched off ball all year, are we capable of doing it in the most pressurized games against a very good team who can attack, who's been working against switching all year long? And I think the thing I would come back to is, and I know people don't like this type of adjustment because it's not an adjustment, is to bring it back to doing what you do best. And we're going to be absolutely relentless, because there's no scouting report for relentless. Curry's relentless on offense. Thompson's relentless on offense, the way they move. The only way, there's no easy way to guard them. There's no way you're going to throw out something and it's going to be easy to execute. It starts with relentless. I don't care if you switch, you don't switch, whatever you do, you're going to have to be more relentless than they are defensively against their offense. Other than that, you're also, I disagree with you on one point where you said you can't think. You have to think. You have to be able to play at full speed and think.
I guess I meant overthink.
I know what you're saying, because it's an old adage, the more you think, the slower your feet. I would disagree. I would just say, with that adage, you have to be able to do both. These series are never one or the other, where you just can play aggressive but not smart. You've got to be able to play aggressively and intelligently. And you've got to be able to know, with all the switching that goes on today, you've got to be able to know, I switch onto this person, my coverages are this. I switch onto that person, his strengths are X, but I have to take away Y. To try to play with dummies on the floor, you will lose. And I think we often talk about in basketball, we got to be a smart team, and then we either select or play dummies. It doesn't work. And I think Toronto is an intelligent team with a bunch of intelligent players. And I think whatever plan they came up with, they have to be relentless in what they do.
I think you just nailed the number one reason why I think Toronto can push the Warriors hard. They're a tenacious defense. They have great defensive personnel. That's obvious. Their whole team is an all-defensive team, right? I mean, and between Lowry, Leonard, who's a defensive player of the year, Gasol's a defensive player of the year, Siakam is going to make an all-defensive team. I thought he was their best regular season defender this year. Danny Green has made all-defensive teams. But not only that, they're smart. They're all really smart. And the reality of the Warriors is, because they have an answer for everything, you have to be able to do everything. You have to be able to execute every like scheme within the scheme in your game plan. You have to be ready to execute all of them on every possession. You have to be able, because you're going to switch who you're guarding, and you just have to have the IQ collectively to be like, okay, I did this. Now I have to do this. I was sagging. Now I have to press. Now I have to do this. Now we're switching. And you have to live in between schemes a lot, in between strategies, which is a very uncomfortable place for a lot of teams. But it's not uncomfortable for Toronto. A, they've switched a lot off the ball all season. Not, maybe not as much as Houston, not as much as the teams we think of as switch teams, but they switch a decent amount. And Kyle Lowry, they love to put Kyle Lowry on post up guys and bigger guys, and they'll put him on Draymond and dare people to post up Kyle Lowry, who's a walking fire hydrant and you can't move him. And they improvise. They're smart. They move around. You can tell the teams who are bad improvisers, all of a sudden three guys are rotating to the same place. They're bumping into each other. Toronto doesn't do that. They move around in concert. They're smart. They can live in that sort of in-between netherworld of schemes that is very difficult for a lot of teams. They are a legitimately very good, mobile, fast, smart defensive team that I think has the goods to look. The Warriors are the greatest offensive team ever. They're the number one offensive team in these playoffs. You're not going to stop the Warriors. You're really not. Contain is even a strong word. You just need to limit them to a point that if you have a good offensive game, you can win. And I think the Raptors can do that.
Well, I agree. I think it starts with a mindset like this. This is not an undoable thing for Toronto. And, you know, I think everybody, particularly against dynasties, they try to paint a picture that you have to play with perfection to win. And it's just not so. And I think it's not going to be easy. It's not supposed to be easy for either team. But it is doable for Toronto. They are equipped from a roster standpoint to get this done. And, you know, I think it all comes down to the ability to handle failure. I see so many teams when their plan takes a hit and Golden State scores four times in a row, even if it's you're playing disciplined defense, the thing that most teams do is they break down and try to make it up the next time. Instead of sticking with the plan and sticking with the plan and knowing that even if you play great defense, they're going to hit you with some haymakers. You can't start making it up because the breakdown in discipline is what happens when a team scores like Golden State can score and hit you with shots that other teams wouldn't dare shoot, let alone make. And I think it's so important for Toronto right off the bat to understand, even if we play it well, they can make some incredible shots. We are not going to break down discipline-wise. We're going to keep doing what we do time and again. And if it's not good enough, then we'll adjust. But we're not going to try to adjust too quickly because there is no sure-proof plan in defending Golden State.
Let's flip it around. Durant would have been their primary option guarding Kawhi Leonard, who has been, as we've said multiple times, just unbelievable in the playoffs. He's really a perfect playoff player because, A, he's the best defensive wing in the league when he wants to be, and B, he's shooting 55% on long twos. And if you can score at that rate on those contested, unassisted shots, you can kind of control the tempo of the game. You can bail your team out when nothing else is working, etc. So Durant would have guarded him. Durant's gone for at least the first game and probably more. What are you doing with Kawhi if you're the Warriors? Are you putting Iguodala on him? How are you guarding him? Are you shading him left as dramatically as the Bucks did? How much help are you sending at him? What's your initial game plan?
Well, I think to start, yeah, Iguodala would be their matchup. And I think I'm going to try to be more square in front of him than I think you give great players – you know, one direction and stand on their side, they're going to be able to beat you. And I think the mid-range jump shot, I think the analytics are so different in the playoffs than they are in the regular season. You need to have guys who can take and make mid-range jump shots. You see it with Kevin Durant. You see it with Curry and Thompson. They don't worry about, am I shooting threes or am I shooting twos? The whole goal is to try to get a good look, a clean look, because it's hard in the playoffs. And Kawhi Leonard's ability to get to a spot and elevate over and get a clean look.
It's amazing how clean it is. Like when he rises up, I don't know if it's because he's so strong he gets guys off balance. I mean, he must be. I would like to actually have Kawhi Leonard kind of hit me a few times because he must be just absolutely rock solid. But to your point, like he does all this hard work and you think, boy, this is going to be an impossible shot. And then on the release, it's like, well, it's a hard shot, but he actually has kind of a nice view of the rim. It's really remarkable.
And I think he gets a lot, you know, back in San Antonio, they had some of the same complaints. I don't want to say complaints. They had some of the same, you know, he was taking some critiques from maybe some unknowing about the same way Durant does. They don't move enough. They don't pass it quick enough. They hold on to the ball. Well, the only reason it works in Toronto is because they want him to do that. Like they don't run a lot of stuff now. They put that ball in his hands, and he goes and he creates. And I mean, they're very simple right now offensively. They pick and roll. They isolate him, and you know, he's not going to be just like Durant is. He's not running around like Curry and Thompson. And if that's what you think, that's what you're attracted to basketball wise, then he's not going to be that guy. I still remember back when without Parker and without Kawhi, Game 6, you would know the year better. They go to Houston and they win by like 39 in one of the great games I've ever seen another team play on the road. And I remember Game 1 in Golden State before Zaza's dirty play against Leonard. People were saying, I had a San Antonio guy come over to me and say, is it possible we're better without Leonard? I'm like, are you crazy? Like, you guys, yeah, you played an all-time game, but they were, this person's point was, he doesn't move or move the ball the same way our other guys do. And my point on that is, yeah, there's no perfect players made, but in crunch time, you need to have a guy who can go get a shot. Kawhi Leonard can get a shot. He can get a shot against elite defense. And that's what he's proven. Like, he's gone against some elite defenders, elite defensive teams, and he's been able to create, not out of tricky offense, but out of isolation, out of post-up, out of pick-and-roll, he's been able to create good shots. And that's hard to do.
The defenses that they've beaten to get here are three of really the best in the league, actually, if you go back and look at Orlando's numbers under Steve Clifford. So you're guarding him with Iguodala, and I assume you're just sort of playing the game that Golden State plays maybe better than anyone else, which is we're gonna zone up behind the player. We're going to show help. Sometimes we're going to pull Draymond Green all the way over so there's an extra guy on Kawhi's side of the floor, and we're just going to have faith that, again, our other players are smart enough and long enough to take away the best passes, recover in time, all of that stuff, right? I mean, this is just what the Warriors do. They overload the floor. They zone up better than anyone else in the league. And you're going to get a certain amount of open threes from your Siakams and your Ibakas and your Gasols and your Norm Powells and Van Vleets. And those guys are going to have to shoot well like they did toward the end of the Milwaukee series. But Golden State is the premier help and recover team in the whole league, with maybe Toronto and Milwaukee right with them.
Well, and it starts with the intelligence and versatility of your players, right? So Draymond Green, he's guarding Siakam. Siakam's above the break. That's going to be a shot he's going to have, and either he makes it or he doesn't, or he moves it along. I think Gasol has to be assertive. I think oftentimes he passes up a really good shot to move it along to nothing, and I think when you pass up good shots in the NBA, oftentimes it's hard to recreate as good a shot later in the clock. So I think it's imperative that he, if they're going to clog the lane or muck up the lane, whatever your term may be, off of him, that he makes the right decisions with the ball. His shot pass decisions are crucial, as are Ibaka's and Siakam's, because there's no doubt, you know, Kawhi Leonard is going to face a man and a half at all times. And I think it's imperative that Lowry stay good, assertive, and Danny Green's got to get back on track and make the makeable shots that he's presented.
Yeah, Danny Green is a big part of this series because, A, he's in a huge slump. B, he's one of the great finals three-point shooters in the history of the league. I mean, you and I were both there in 2013 where he literally, not literally, but when he became like fire incarnate on the court for four games and just could not miss a shot. But that's who Steph Curry is going to hide on. And it almost feels insulting to say they're hiding Steph Curry because he's a competitive, competent defender, but that's what they're doing. They're hiding him. And if they, you know, the Cavs, their entire game plan was based around hunting Steph Curry. Now, they had maybe the greatest pick and roll passer of all time and a bunch of really good screeners for him and J.R. Smith and Kyrie Irving and all that. And that's a good way to get Steph Curry in foul trouble and all of that. The Raptors haven't really been able to get into a rhythm hunting the guys who are guarding Danny Green like that. It's not at the top of Kawhi's skill set to sort of get rid of the ball early like that. Danny Green is just not going to do much for you. Like Kyrie could short roll and make plays off the dribble. And if he can't make shots, like I just don't know if they're going to be able to hunt Curry and get him in foul trouble the way that Cleveland and other teams have done, but he's going to have to make shots. And if he can't, this becomes a big Van Vliet series because if you have Van Vliet and Lowry on the floor at the same time, Curry has to guard someone who's now a threat in the pick and roll, and that's a different way to sort of go at him. So that's an interesting dynamic to me. Before I let you go, any other X factors, whether it's a player or a rebounding or transition or turnovers, any other X factors that are particularly sort of appealing to you?
Well, I just think it's a game of habits, and the simple things that are hard to do, like transition defense. I thought that Portland's greatest downfall was not their half-court defense. It was their inability offensively, but also they got beat down the floor after made baskets too often because of the push of Draymond Green.
That game three that you were noting during the game, I mean, Draymond Green hasn't played many finer games than that. When they were kind of lifeless and behind, and he was the only reason they were in the game, and he was just one on two. I'm going. It was really remarkable.
Yeah, and so transition defense and offensive rebounding, people actually try to go to the offensive boards a little bit more in the playoffs. So your ability to secure the rebound and those things work together: transition defense and offensive rebounding decisions. And then your one-on-one defense, you know, can you stay in front of the ball without fouling? I think you mentioned about Curry, about hunting him, about foul trouble. Some of the things that he does foul-wise when he finds himself in trouble are inexplicable. They really are. And he's got to be disciplined.
Without Durant, right? I mean, he can't afford, like he had one in Houston where he picked up his second foul real fast and you went nuts on him and you were right. He stepped forward 5 feet and got under Harden. You're like, man, Durant's out. Like you can't be on the bench for the next. Now they won the game anyway. So what the hell do I know?
No, they did, but it's all good until you don't win, right? So you don't do things and say the greatest coaching line is you can't tolerate in victory what you wouldn't tolerate in defeat. Right. And so you have to be able to correct as you go along and win. And so, like, if you're Curry, like, there are going to be plays and bang, bang plays. And I think his individual defense at times is very good. And I think, you know, it's become habit just to say he's a weak defender or whatever it is. I look at it differently. I think at times he does a very good job in his one-on-one defense and he's competitive, but you can't let your competitive spirit overrule your decision making. And at times the way he whacks at the ball, it just puts his team in a predicament with Durant, but particularly without Durant. And I think he's got to be disciplined. So those would be, you know, the normal things of transition defense and offensive rebounding or defensive rebounding. And then, you know, does Curry play with foul trouble or without foul trouble?
Yeah, those are all good. And to your point, Golden State's offensive rebounding in the playoffs, I think their offensive rebounding rate is like 30%, top three in the league. And they have a history of sort of sneakily ramping up their offensive rebounding against teams who don't expect it. So that's what I'm watching. And this is too big to be an X factor, but I just feel like the assertiveness of Lowry and Gasol defines almost, like, Leonard is going to do what he does. And sometimes he's going to do it at an A++ level, and sometimes it's an A- level. But, like, that's normal. Lowry and Gasol have to be assertive. And like, I, before the playoffs, I picked Toronto to make the finals. And then I picked the Bucks in the conference finals when we had to repick every series. And the reason I did that is because I lost faith. Game 7 against Philly and much of the other part of that Philly series, I lost a little faith in the Raptors because Lowry and Gasol just didn't want to shoot. They just didn't want any part of the ball in Game 7. And I thought, well, if this is how they're reacting to pressure, I'm just a little less confident about their chances in the next round against a really great Milwaukee team. And I think I underestimated sort of what it feels like to get through a Game 7 and get through a series and get a look at a new opponent who feels differently and is a little smaller and the fresh start you get in a Game 1. And after a cold start, Gasol was great after Game 2 mostly. Lowry was great the whole series. They're going to have to play that way every second of the series. There is no margin for error anymore. And so, like, when Kyle Lowry gets Kevon Looney on him on a switch, like, that's just got to be predator mode. You got to hit step back threes. You got to break out the hesitation dribble and dust him to the rim. Like, you can't be hot potatoing out of these things, to your point. So that's what I'm most interested to watch, because I was impressed particularly by how Lowry, right off the bat in Milwaukee in Game 1, got his game back and sustained it the entire series, and that's what they need to have a chance.
Yeah, I agree. He's going to have to be really good.
Well, it's going to be a fun series. I hope it's a fun series. I will see you up in Toronto. Jeff Van Gundy, your work on TV has been great. Your work with our Team USA qualifying team was awesome, and I know something you were really proud of, so congrats again on that. And I will see you soon in the Great White North, my friend.
You got it. Take care.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.